This is Let's Hear It on WMUK. We turn now to a performance this Saturday night in Chenery Auditorium in Kalamazoo, featuring the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus, along with the Arcato Chamber Ensemble, performing Mozart's Requiem under the direction of Bachfest director Jim Turner. Earlier today, Jim was in the studio with me, along with conductor Andrew Kohler and historian Zaid Pixley, who will give a pre-concert talk at 7 p.m. before the concert begins at 8. Jim says this performance has been years in the making.
We had a conversation a couple of years ago, and I made the plan based on what I really would like to do. As I may be headed towards retirement, and this is one of my favorite works of all times. This will be my fourth time preparing and conducting the Requiem, and we are thrilled to be able to present this in Chenery Auditorium.
So it's a very special performance for you. What are some of the other wish list pieces you've been able to do in recent years?
Last year, the Brahms Requiem in collaboration with Andrew. Next year, the fifth, final year of the five-year plan will be the B minor Mass.
That's a big, big
That's
one.
That's a big song.
You're thinking about that already, I bet.
I bet we are.
Well, this Saturday is the Mozart Requiem. This, I know from the movie, was the last piece that he composed, and it may not have been finished entirely by Mozart. He wrote a lot of sketches, I understand. Did he complete some of it, like the first couple movements?
The only movement completely finished, orchestra and chorus writing completely done by Mozart, is the introit, the first movement. And then he provided sketches, and there's a lot of speculation about how Zeus Meyer interpreted some of those sketches that Zaid and Andrew will talk about. And the final three movements, they're barely sketches. For the chorus, no orchestration, so those had to be completed.
And who did you bring together to perform this? Who are you excited about featuring as soloists?
I'm going to start with our bass baritone soloist, Ian Greenlaw, who was just in town not too long ago singing Barbara Seville, Figaro, with the KSO. And some of his career highlights include his Metropolitan Opera debut, singing the Britain's War Requiem with the New York Philharmonic. He also performed with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Dallas Symphony, National Symphony Orchestra, and he is a recipient of the Richard Tucker Career Grant Award. So we are thrilled that he was free to do this.
What is his name again?
Ian Greenlaw.
Ian Greenlaw. What a wealth of experience.
Absolutely. We're so excited that he was free to do this. Our tenor, pardon me, is Jeffrey Pecan. And he is in residence during the summer at Bayview, and that's how I got his name. He is currently professor of voice and diction at Oklahoma City University. And some of his credits include singing with City Opera, New York City Opera, Dallas Opera, Pittsburgh Opera. He was a part of an Emmy Award-winning production of Madame Butterfly for New York City Opera, live from Lincoln Center. So another outstanding soloist, our tenor. Our mezzo-soprano soloist is Phyllis Pancella. She just this summer finished her Santa Fe Opera debut, and she will return to Santa Fe in 2016 for solo recital. Her credits include the Mozart Requiem with the Handel and Haydn Society. Her opera roles have ranged from Carmen to Lizzie Borden to Nero. She has sung with Houston Grand Opera, Chicago Lyric Opera.
Wow. One
of the things I found most interesting about her bio statement is that her last sentence is, "But all of this pales in comparison with the opportunity to share the stage and make music in Kalamazoo with her brother, Paul Pancella." And Paul has been singing in the Bach Choir for about 15 years, and he's actually chair of the physics department at Western. So I find that so endearing. And actually, it was Paul who suggested that I contact Phyllis several years ago, and it happened to be she was free to perform this.
What a wonderful connection.
Yeah, the choir is going to be so excited to meet her because of Paul's involvement with Bach Festival for so long. And our soprano soloist has sung with the Bach 4 years ago. She was the angel in the Law to the Nativity by Respighi that we performed at our Christmas concert. Mm-hmm. She is a full-time professor of voice at Grand Valley State University and an exquisite singer, and she's performed with Des Moines Opera, Grand Rapids Opera, Toledo Symphony, Grand Rapids Symphony, and the Cincinnati Vocal Arts Ensemble. And she has a vast amount of experience doing cantata and oratorio work. So we're thrilled to have these four soloists.
They're just so they're international artists. It's a really great thing to have them in Kalamazoo on Saturday to perform Mozart's Requiem.
And there are two very, very prominent solo quartet movements in the Requiem, which gives the choir a chance to sit down and get ready for the next movement. So they're quite prominent as a quartet in the work.
Well, maybe now I will talk to Andrew about the Arcado Ensemble, which we don't usually chat about. We're usually talking about your other groups, the Kalamazoo Philharmonia or the Junior Symphony. Tell me about Arcado.
Well, the Arcado was something that was made possible for the first time several years ago through a grant from the Arts Council. And one is always looking for extra opportunities to make music. I certainly am. And I've collected so many good friends and colleagues, professional musicians in town. And I thought there's some wonderful players here that I really love working with. And when I was able to get this grant from the Arts Council, I put them together into a small chamber ensemble and called it the Arcado, and we put on a concert. And through the generosity of the Arts Council, I've now been able to do three concerts with Arcado. And then recently, Corey Summers, who's the new executive director of the Bach Festival organization, said, and who has played in Arcado before, is a wonderful violinist herself, said, well, what if Arcado could be part of the Bach Festival week? And I jumped at the opportunity. It was just, it's such a wonderful idea. So it's already an organization that I personally, the Bach Festival, have a lot of relationship with. And to be able to take another segment of my musical life, the Arcado Chamber Ensemble, and then put it together with the Bach Festival was just a wonderful collaborative opportunity.
I seem to remember the first Arcado concert was all strings, right? And the name Arcado is string related. Yeah.
You've got it exactly right. Yeah, it simply means bowed. That's where the name came from. And the first concert was all strings. Our second concert was again all strings. Our third concert had a couple wind players in it. And now this one will have even more. But I would argue that, the heart of any chamber orchestra or orchestra is still going to be, there's going to be a string section in there somewhere. So as such, I think it's okay to keep calling it Arcado.
I think there's a certain trombonist out there, whoever he or she is,
who might object to that characterization.
Because there's a very important trombone part in this.
There is an essential trombone part. There's no question about it. And it's one of the legendary excerpts for trombone. It's a very difficult part. That having been said, though, my point is simply that there will always be strings, just about always, in an orchestral context.
Well, it is just about time to delve into the music and hear some music so we can all take a break and enjoy it. So I need an introduction to the Mozart, and I guess we need to begin with movement one. Who can tell me, Zaid, can you tell me the circumstances under which this work was commissioned and how far, at what condition Mozart was in when he was writing it?
It's one of the most fascinating stories, really, in composition. And this is a wonderful piece of music, and it was immediately famous because of its complicated history of composition. And for me, one of the fascinating things is how a story or an idea will get out, and then people will repeat that idea and repeat it until it becomes accepted fact, even though it may not have ever been accepted fact. And Andrew can talk a little bit about the Zusmeier orchestrations, which have been roundly criticized, and now not so much. But I just want to say briefly, there are so many myths about this Requiem. I've had a great time trying to unravel some of them. For example, the unknown messenger who came with the anonymous commission really was probably known to Mozart, because he was commissioning for Count Walsegg, who frequently asked composers to write music for him that he would then perform under his name. And Mozart's friend, Johann Michael von Buchborg, lived in Walsegg's villa in Vienna. And they were close friends. Mozart undoubtedly tumbled to this. Also, the reason he included basset horns in the score was that he knew that basset horns would be available at an unspecified performance date. So we think Mozart probably was much more aware of that than the story goes. And it was just over a year later, however, that the first account came out in Mozart's hometown Salzburg newspaper saying that he didn't know who had come and that he had become obsessed with writing his own Requiem. And some of the details in that suggest that it came from Mozart's inner circle. There really isn't evidence to support that was actually a fact. He was in quite good spirits when he went to Prague. He became ill on November 20th and then died on December 5th. People did not think he was going to die. It was really kind of a sudden end. So we think that the accounts of all of the drama around this have been greatly exaggerated, probably because his wife, Constanze, who the scholar Robbins Landon says is the most maligned woman in music, unfairly, Constanze was left with two children to support, and they really had to find ways to support the family, which Mozart was desperate to do before he died. So this, as our friend Terry Williams says, this story was really too good to check about whether it actually happened exactly that way. But it is a tenacious and dramatic story, which also helped to cast Mozart as kind of a romantic hero, which pointed to the romantic era that was bursting upon the musical world as someone, a misunderstood genius. So the facts may belie that, but it's a great story.
Do the original manuscripts exist? Do we have his handwriting on this Requiem?
We do. Yes, actually, and they're widely publicly available. So there are two extant scores that are quite easy to get your hands on, and they reside in the Österreichische Nationalbibliothek, the Austrian National Library. There's one that has Mozart's hand on it, and it shows us pretty clearly how far he got in writing the score, and that also has on it the hands of two other authors, close confidants and pupils of Mozart's, Eibler and Freistetler. And you can, those with especially good eyes, I'm not sure that mine are quite good enough, can really discern the difference in the manuscript handwriting to kind of see where they filled in. All of the basic parts of the music in these movements is completed by Mozart. He wrote through all the choral parts and the figured bass, the bass line, and then sometimes the additional orchestration is from these other gentlemen. And then there's the so-called completion score, which is based on that same fragment and that is filled out by Süssmayr. There are several other movements that he wrote, and which does seem to pretty closely correspond to what Süssmayr himself said at the end of his life about what he contributed to the Requiem.
Did he begin composing the Requiem before he got ill?
Yes, he had already started composing the Requiem before he got ill. And as Zaid points out, up until something most people think until about 2 days before his actual untimely death, Mozart and everyone else anticipated a full recovery, so there was no real sense that that story that Zaid mentions, the idea that Mozart was quoted as saying, "This is a requiem for myself," is something that Costanze, his wife, told many years later. And as with everything, because of her vested interest in trying to make sure the work's popularity got out there, is possibly spurious. I mean, it's certainly questionable at any rate.
It's funny because I hear what you're saying, setting the record straight, and yet the power of that image of the movie is so strong that I still see him lying in bed, you know, desperately writing out pages and sweating and looking so awful. It is really hard to overturn.
Well, maybe even more importantly, the music itself, I think, paints the picture of a person who is profoundly afraid of death. I mean, I think that's inherent in the music, and I think that helps support our notion. And there's nothing to say that maybe even if he wasn't exactly, what was that actor's name, Tom Hulce or something like that? Maybe if he wasn't a pasty Tom Hulce in his nightgown there, even without that part of the image, I think, you know, sticking just to the music itself, we hear someone who is grappling with his own mortality. And that's something we all have to face, whether it's coming very soon or a little later on.
So just to inject some facts here, the last bit of the Requiem. Oh, that isn't what I meant, Andrew, at all.
Those were facts. I'm not sure what you're saying, Zaid.
No, I'm obsessed with the trying to uncover what happened at all. Andrew's greatly in command of the facts, far more than I. But where I was headed with this was that his last writing on the Requiem was written in a very firm hand, probably at a desk. And then he was really, because of his illness, unable to write because his joints were swollen because of the rheumatic fever. And just a little tidbit about his death, the treatment hastened his death because he was bled. And then his doctor, when Mozart became really ill, put cold compresses on him. Not sure what that is, but it sounds quite dire, which precipitated cardiac arrest. So there are a lot of background facts about what happened.
The piece begins with an introitus rather than a Kyrie. I'm used to requiems or masses beginning with a Kyrie. So introitus, I'm guessing, is an introduction?
Yeah, it's exactly. It's the processional at the beginning of the mass. And it's not an uncommon movement to have in a requiem mass, but certainly not all composers have chosen to set it.
Okay. We'll listen to a movement from the Mozart Requiem performed here in a live recording with the Vienna State Opera Choir, the Vienna Philharmonic, Sir George Scholte conducting. From the Mozart Requiem, we heard the opening. This work will be performed on Saturday at 8 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, presented by the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus, along with the Arcado Chamber Ensemble. The two conductors of each group are here today, James Turner of the Bach Festival Chorus and Andrew Kohler of Arcado Chamber Ensemble, as well as historian and researcher Zaid Pixley, who has done a lot of research into the Mozart Requiem. And she'll be giving listeners the inside scoop, as it were, on Saturday in a presentation starting at 7 p.m. Again, that's at Chenery Auditorium. And this performance kicks off the annual Bach Festival week in Kalamazoo with a whole series of events to follow Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and the following Saturday. I did want to ask about this collaborator, this Franz Süssmayr, who we always hear in reference to the Requiem. And Zaid, perhaps you can fill us in on this individual and what part he played in Mozart's life.
He was 10 years younger than Mozart and came to Vienna working with Mozart as kind of a disciple and pupil. He did some composition with Mozart, most likely on the recitatives in La Clemenza di Tito, which is a serious opera written for the coronation of the new King of Austria, right as Mozart was to be working on the Requiem. He also worked on that. And there is evidence, anecdotal evidence, that he worked with Mozart on the, as Mozart was dying, about what would go in various places. Why don't you say something about the Amen fugue and about what happens at the end?
Well, that's an interesting point. So, I mean, Süssmayr did claim, and again, there's always these questions, right? I mean, because everyone kind of had their own reasons for claiming what they might have wanted to, but that Mozart did give him instruction at the end of his life about how he ought to complete the Requiem. But one thing that's been discovered very recently is I think only in the last maybe 30, something, I mean, in the last 30 years, is an extant sketch of an Amen fugue in D minor, which is the overriding key of this Requiem. And it's on the backside of a sketch for something in the Magic Flute, which was being written at the same time. So you start thinking, I mean, Mozart was not composing a lot of sacred music at this time, and here's an Amen, absolutely, unquestionably sacred piece of music in the key of the Requiem that clearly is from the right time period because it has another work that was being written concurrently on its other side. So there is a version of this Requiem out there that posits that the end of the sequence, this long next movement that we might listen to a little bit of, should not in fact end with simply one cadence where the chorus sings Amen at the end of Lacrimosa, but an entire fugue. And it's been pointed out, one of the people who believes very strongly that this is how it ought to end with this fugue points out that that means that every major section of the Requiem then ends with a fugue, which has a kind of nice sort of mirroring effect and balance to it, yeah.
I wanted to just add something about Mozart's contrapuntal writing. He and his colleague Haydn, who admired Mozart very much, studied the works of Bach together in the early 1780s in Vienna with Baron von Swieten, a friend and patron, and then both of them became much more contrapuntal in their writing. And counterpoint really is in many places in the Requiem, not just as the fugues, but kind of suffusing the whole text and then dramatically contrasted to other styles of writing. And if I could add about the sequence, it's particular to the Requiem Mass. It's not part of the Mass Ordinary, but it's particular to a funeral Mass. The text from this one goes to about 1250, and it is obviously very old in its style. Mozart was the first to capture those images, those apocalyptic images in the music, and really pointed forward to the Berlioz Requiem and the Brahms Requiem and the Verdi Requiems for an opera composer to be seeing Dies Irae and all of the various images was irresistible.
Mm. We're going to hear the Dies Irae and let it move into this Tuba Mirum. We gave a hint earlier about that. It's a famous trombone solo, as well as one of the soloists will have a moment here.
Exactly right, yeah.
Music from the Mozart Requiem, the Dies Irae, and Tuba Mirum, which begins the sequence, the second section of the Requiem. This work will be performed on Saturday as the opening concert of Bach Festival Week, presented by the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus and the Arcata Chamber Ensemble. The two conductors are here, Arcata's Andrew Kohler and Bach Festival Chorus's Jim Turner, and historian and researcher Zaid Pixley of Kalamazoo College, who will be presenting a pre-concert talk on Mozart's Requiem at 7 p.m. Music begins at 8 o'clock. Full details online at kalamazoobachfestival.org. Jim, I'd like to turn to you and ask, when you are preparing a work like this over months of rehearsals with your chorus, what do you pick out to work on first and most intensively?
The fugal sections, like the Kyrie we listened to earlier.
Okay.
And the very end when that fugue is repeated with a different text, the Cum Sanctis. It's making sure that all of our 16th notes line up together with the orchestra because they're all doubling 16th notes. And that's a real challenge to make sure singers have the vocal technique to move their voices very quickly.
Audiences will hear it tearing away if it starts to not line up.
Our biggest challenge in singing the fugues and also singing some of the movements that are sustained, like the Agnus Dei, is in the Latin pronunciation, according to Roman usage, which is what we are using. Many singers, including myself, learn the Latin with an Italian slant. And so, for example, J-E-S-U with Italian Latin is Jesu, which is actually more musical to sing than the, according to Roman usage, it would be Jesu, not the Z, but with an S, and not an A, but E. And so if one stays with that pronunciation guide, the requiem, the opening statement is re, eh. And to get that in tune, pardon me, whether it's sustaining or singing a fugue is a real challenge. So we learn the fugues on the easiest sounds the choir can produce before we actually plunge into the Latin.
The concert again is Saturday night at 8 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, which is a beautiful venue. The concert, I should say, Andrew, actually includes more than the Requiem, which is about 50 to 55 minutes long. But you've also included a special treat.
Exactly, a little amuse-bouche or something at the end, right? At the beginning, I should say. Jim was so generous in saying that since the Arcado was playing, that I could conduct something on the performance as well, and it'll be a really fun evening for me because I get to start with conducting something and then move into the orchestra and play the Requiem with Jim conducting. But I thought long and hard about what it might be, and there's this very severe Adagio and Fugue that Mozart wrote near the end of his life, and then I thought, but you know what else he wrote near the end of his life? Eine kleine Nachtmusik, you know, that most quintessential, maybe the most famous piece of classical music ever, that iconic dum dun 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 dum that will be known to every listener. And I just thought it was the perfect encapsulation of this other side of Mozart that we know, you know, the sort of effortless genius, the someone who could sit down and produce what was occasional music. This was just music for we don't know very much about the circumstances of its production, but it was just meant for a party. And yet in a way, knowing that he could toss something like this off so well, yet that is so full of incredibly beautiful melody and just perfect assured writing and that quintessential wittiness of his music, I thought was a beautiful way to paint the other side of Mozart near the end of his life, right? I mean, that's a Mozart we know and love as well, in addition to this serious Mozart grappling with mortality and the end of life.
What did the musicians say with such contrasting pieces, you know? This really is a big contrast, I think, to the Requiem. But I, for one, am really glad that you're sort of giving us, you know, this is for you people. You know, I know I have these great unknown pieces that need to be heard, but I'm giving you the Eine kleine Nachtmusik.
Yeah, I think that for me, that was a big part of the consideration. You know, I spend a lot of my time finding repertoire that I think is unjustly neglected. And I thought, you know, let me not also forget that there's a reason why this is such a really famous work. That's always the feeling I have when I come back to a work like Eine kleine Nachtmusik. You know, you think, it's brilliant. It's just totally brilliant from the first note to the last. It's just a perfect jewel of a creation. And it is justly celebrated, and it's okay to keep celebrating and enjoying it. And the other thing that I love is that it'll be a nice opportunity for the orchestra, I think, you know, to play something that's already known to us, but to maybe see if we can't push ourselves to do something really special with it, because it's already something that we no doubt know well.
Really, really memorable, with a famous piece that, to be honest, I haven't heard in Kalamazoo in some years.
There you go. So. It's time.
And this is a perfect illustration of what Leopold Mozart told his son earlier in Mozart's life, which was, why does everything have to be so difficult? you can write things that are accessible to an amateur who that also delight the connoisseur by their mysteries and their melodies, and that seems to be a perfect example.
I just looked at the clock. We are 6 minutes away from the top of the hour. And so I want at this point to talk about some of the other delightful treats coming up during Bach Festival Week, which begins Saturday at 8 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium with this very special performance, Mozart's Requiem, beginning with the Eine kleine Nachtmusik, with the Arcado Chamber Ensemble and the Bach Festival Chorus. Jim, can you talk a little about what's coming up in the following week for the annual Bach Festival Week?
Yes, I'll be happy to. The following day, Sunday, April the 10th, we began this several years ago, a project where we invite cities, churches in the city, to perform Bach in their Sunday services. And this year we have 10 churches that have chosen to perform Bach in their worship services. So we're thrilled about that. The next event we have is the annual Bach Around the Block. It's the 29th annual organ crawl. It begins at the First United Methodist Church. It goes to the First Presbyterian Church and ends at St. Luke's Episcopal. And again, I don't know if I said this, that begins at 7 o'clock on Monday night.
That's free, right?
I'm sorry?
That's free.
That is free. And then the next event we're sponsoring is the Bach Legacy Recital Series, which is Tuesday, April the 12th at 7 o'clock. That will feature works of Bach, but also some other composers, including Couperin and Dvorak and Villa-Lobos. And again, that is free. That's at 7 o'clock, April the 12th, Tuesday, April the 12th. Then the next day, Wednesday, April the 13th, at noon, we have a lunchtime recital, again, at the college, which will feature works of Bach and Mozart. We have a composition of Dvorak and William Byrd as well. And then our final event will be Saturday, April the 16th, at 3 o'clock, which is also free to the public. And we will be presenting the winners of our Young Vocalist competition, and I'll be hosting that. And the audience will be able to hear the high school winners as well as the four college winners of that event. So we're hoping that people will be able to attend that. I don't think we'll be competing with beautiful weather, so so hopefully people will opt to come to a recital in the middle of a Saturday afternoon.
All the details on these events are available at KalamazooBachFestival.org. Thank you all for coming in to preview this concert Saturday night. It's bound to be a very special concert. Final words, Zaid? Anything that you can think of at the end of this hour here?
I think I want to thank WMUK for your enthusiastic coverage of the arts in our community. It's really important, and thank you for the chance to talk about this in such detail.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Jim?
Thank you so much. We have tickets available, and I don't know if we gave that number, but I'll give it again just in case. It is 337-7407, and that's the Bach Festival office. And thank you as well for giving us this opportunity to talk about the Requiem.
Well, I couldn't do it without you. And take it away, Andrew.
I thought maybe as we're ending the hour, we might listen to a little bit of the Lacrimosa, which is the last part of the sequence, the unique part of the Requiem. And it's music that we know from the sketches that Mozart did not complete. He wrote the first 8 bars, and that was the last thing that he was able to finish. But I think that this completion, we're not totally sure who did all of it, but it's still an absolutely stunning piece of music. And what Mozart suggested in those few 8 bars as it was completed, I think, is truly one of the most affecting moments in the Western musical canon. So here's a little bit of that Lacrimosa, the Day of Tears.